This episode of Navarra Live is brought to you by listeners like you. Thank you.
Good evening and welcome to Navarra Live. My name is Aaron Bastani. Tonight I have the immense pleasure of being joined by the other half of the B team, Mike Bancole. Mike, how are we?
Yeah, not too bad, Aaron. It's always a good day when it's a Tuesday and the B team are back in action at 6 p.m. on Navarra Live. So looking forward to the show today.
Yeah, we've got a tough show tonight. Some pretty hard stories. Coming up later tonight, we look at the Israeli bombing of the Iranian consulate in Syria and what that means for conflict in the wider region. Labour have seemingly indicated that a government led by Keir Starmer would continue to sell arms to Israel, and news on how Benjamin Netanyahu is moving further to shut out Al Jazeera from operating in Israel and Palestine. Stay tuned for all of that. First story. Seven international aid workers have been killed in Israeli airstrikes on their vehicles in Gaza. The aid workers were part of World Central Kitchen, a US-based NGO attempting to ease the impending famine in the territory. Three British citizens are among the dead, as well as a Polish man, an Australian woman, and a dual US-Canadian citizen. The Palestinian driver of the vehicle was also killed in that attack. The strike took place yesterday evening after a convoy of three World Central Kitchen vehicles, all bearing the organization's logo, accompanied an aid truck to a food warehouse in central Gaza. After unloading 100 tons of aid at that warehouse, the convoy returned along a route the organization had pre-approved with the IDF as part of standard deconfliction protocols. Haaretz reports that IDF sources say it was then that the order was given in the military control room to fire on the aid workers. Now, the first vehicle was hit by a missile from a Hermes 450 drone. According to Haaretz's sources, people could be seen emerging from the struck vehicle and getting into one of the other cars. At that point, the aid workers reportedly notified the IDF they had been struck. Yet, seconds later, a missile hit the second car. Passengers from the third car then tried to pick up those who survived that second strike, and it was then that the third missile hit them. All seven World Central Kitchen workers in that convoy were killed. Israel claimed responsibility for the attack this morning, and this was IDF spokesperson Daniel Hagari.
Last night, an incident took place in Gaza that resulted in the tragic death of World Central Kitchen employees as they fulfilled their vital mission of bringing food to people in need. As a professional military committed to international law, we are committed to examining our operations thoroughly and transparently. I just spoke to WCK founder Chef Jose Anders and expressed the deepest condolences of Israel Defense Forces to the families and the entire World Central Kitchen family. We also express sincere sorrow to our allied nations who have been doing and continue to do so much to assist those in need. We have been reviewing the incident in the highest levels to understand the circumstances of what happened and how it happened. We will be opening a probe to examine this serious incident further. This will help us reduce the risk of such an event from occurring again.
Now, you've just watched that clip. Given what I previously said about the nature of the attack, you can make your own mind up as to how honest and sincere Mr. Hagari's words were. Israel's Prime Minister, meanwhile, Benjamin Netanyahu, has also commented on the killings. He said this: "Unfortunately, in the last day, there was a tragic case of our forces unintentionally hitting innocent people in the Gaza Strip. It happens in war. We're fully examining this. We are in contact with the governments and we will do everything so that this thing does not happen again." Netanyahu there is claiming that the strike was unintentional, or rather three strikes. But further reporting from Haaretz suggests that may not be the case. The IDF strike was aimed at an armed Hamas member that the Israelis believed was in the convoy. That's according to Haaretz's defense sources. there was no Hamas member in that convoy. But what the actions of the IDF show is that they were prepared to kill known international humanitarian workers, including people from Britain, as collateral damage in pursuit of a single member of Hamas. Remember, they fired 3 missiles at the convoy in what looks like a deliberate effort to make sure that nobody survived. A defense source told Haaretz this: "It's frustrating. We're trying our hardest to accurately hit terrorists and utilizing every thread of intelligence. And in the end, the units in the field decide to launch attacks without any preparation in cases that have nothing to do with protecting our forces." Following news of the deadly strike, World Central Kitchen CEO Erin Gore said this: "This is not only an attack against WCK, this is an attack on humanitarian organizations showing up in the most dire of situations where food is being used as a weapon of war. This is unforgivable. I am heartbroken and appalled that we, World Central Kitchen and the world, lost beautiful lives today because of a targeted attack by the IDF. The love they had for feeding people, that is the people killed, the determination they embody to show that humanity rises above all, and the impact they made in countless lives will forever be remembered and cherished." The organization says it has immediately halted operations in Gaza. It's also being reported that other organizations are following suit. Now, critically here, World Central Kitchen was the only international organization overseeing the transfer of aid through the maritime corridor between Cyprus and Gaza. A spokesperson for Cyprus's foreign ministry told The Guardian this: "Around 332 tons of aid left Cyprus on Saturday. Around 100 tons, about a third, were unloaded and delivered. But after these tragic events, the other two thirds are being brought back." Just extraordinary. "Obviously, we will have to wait now until the whole process of inquiry is carried out. We have to wait and see if WCK resumes operations." Just an extraordinary series of statements there, including the head of the WCK saying this was intentional, and now food is heading back away from Gaza, a place which is being subject to famine. Israel's ongoing assault on Gaza has made it the world's most dangerous place to deliver aid, and the killing of the World Central Kitchen aid workers brings the number of humanitarian workers killed in Gaza to over 200. Now, most of those have been Palestinian, but the killing of international workers has caused a global condemnation. Foreign Secretary David Cameron said this on X: "The news of the airstrike that killed World Central Kitchen aid workers in Gaza is deeply distressing. British nationals are reported to have been killed. That's now confirmed. There were 3 of them. We are urgently working to verify this information and will provide full support to their families. We have called on Israel to immediately investigate and provide a full, transparent explanation of what happened." Later, David Cameron gave this update: "I spoke with Israeli Foreign Minister Israel Katz to underline that the deaths of WCK aid workers in Gaza, including 3 British nationals, are completely unacceptable. Israel must urgently explain how this happened and make major changes to ensure safety of aid workers on the ground." The Foreign Office has also now summoned Israel's ambassador to the UK, and the leaders of Poland and Australia have also called on Israel to explain itself. Meanwhile, the Polish Attorney General has opened a criminal investigation into the killings. In France, US Secretary of State Antony Blinken said this about the strike:
"The victims of yesterday's strike join a record number of humanitarian workers who've been killed in this particular conflict. These people are heroes. They run into the fire, not away from it. They show the best of what humanity has to offer when the going really gets tough. They have to be protected. We shouldn't have a situation where people who are simply trying to help their fellow human beings are themselves at grave risk. We've spoken directly to the Israeli government about this particular incident. We've urged a swift, a thorough, an impartial investigation to understand exactly what happened. And as we have throughout this conflict. We've impressed upon the Israelis the absolute imperative of doing more to protect innocent civilian lives, be they Palestinian children, women, and men, or be they aid workers.
Other international leaders, however, couldn't bring themselves to even name the perpetrators of the atrocity. President of the EU Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, said this: "I pay homage to the @WCK workers who lost their lives in Gaza. @WC Kitchen is a crucial partner in alleviating the suffering of the people of Gaza, including by channeling food via the maritime corridor. My deepest condolences to their families and friends." If we can just leave that there for a second. Incredible. "I pay homage to the aid workers who lost their lives. A crucial partner. My deepest condolences." No mention of where they came from. And no mention, like I say, of who was responsible. Ursula von der Leyen seems to be more upset about the fact that wild wolves killed her pet pony in southern Germany, which has led to a cull of wolves in that part of the world. She seems to get more animated about things like that than about innocent humanitarian workers being murdered. At present, only two of the killed aid workers have been named. This is L'Alzomi Franco, filmed a week ago in World Central Kitchen's Deir al-Bala kitchen. The 43-year-old was an Australian national from Melbourne. She had worked with World Central Kitchen for 5 years. Damian Sobol, a Polish citizen from Szemeszel, was also killed in the attack. He joined World Central Kitchen after volunteering to help Ukrainian refugees fleeing into Poland at the outbreak of the war in Ukraine. Remarkable man. The Palestinian driver of one of the vehicles has also been named as Saif Issam Abu Taha. He came from Rafah and died trying to help feed his fellow Gazans. Mike, this story has just knocked me for six. I mean, we've been covering this now for more than 6 months. And obviously, quantitatively, much worse has happened. Qualitatively, what much worse has happened. We've seen children starving to death. We've seen 13,000 kids die. We've seen things I never thought we'd see. However, even with all that in mind, I am most shocked by the fact that a British Foreign Secretary, the British government, don't seem to care that much about UK nationals being killed in this way in Gaza.
Yeah, I don't think they've understood the gravity of the situation, right? And I think we have to understand that this isn't just a random act. And I think part of the problem with the UK government's response to this is they still believe Israel's acting in good faith. So Cameron's tweet, the idea that Israel should investigate itself, I mean, that's a tweet that's kind of implicitly informed by the idea that, well, we trust Israel to kind of sort this out because, you know, they didn't mean to do this really, kind of. Like, that's the kind of understanding there. Like, this is just a mishap. It happens. But this isn't a mishap. Israeli ministers have spoken about the need to starve Gaza. Right, so this is part of its genocidal project and part of a wider plan of suffering. Right, so the idea is if you target aid workers, there are two things that happen. Right, you know, you limit the ability of those aid workers to literally do their job, which is deliver aid. But also, what you're saying is you're sending a message and saying, well, actually, anyone else who wants to come over here and deliver aid, that could be your fate. So you don't come over here. So let's be absolutely clear about this. This is targeted. This is deliberate. It's not part of some kind of mishaps or some accidental act. But people aren't seeming to grasp this. And I think there are two responses we're seeing from governments around the world on this. You're seeing either the kind of tepid response of some, which is, you know, thoughts and prayers with those affected. This is really, really terrible. Or you're seeing this framing of Israel acting in good faith and it's just mishaps. Both of these are completely wrong and completely stupid approaches at this stage of proceedings, right? We're 6 months into this. This is not about good faith actors. We know Israel are not acting in good faith. And that should be the framing. That should be the starting point of any analysis of anything that's going on in Gaza right now. So I just feel so frustrated, so upset and so sad by the response. And I think you're right, Aaron. It isn't like, given this has been such a horrible kind of 6 months, it isn't the worst thing that's happened, but it's just another reminder of the lack of care and compassion our politicians have during arguably the greatest crime of our age, right? You know, this is something that has such huge implications. We're seeing thousands of children die. There's a report in The Guardian this earlier on by a doctor who spoke about how this is not a normal war at all, and spoke about the thousands of children, the tens of thousands of children have been murdered during this fight. So this is not normal, and loads of terrible things have happened. But that kind of a final reminder, or another reminder, that our government simply don't care, even when British citizens are being killed, was quite tough to take. So that makes it, I think, you know, it's horrible. It really is horrible. But I think this kind of framing of Israel acting in good faith needs to stop, because they simply aren't.
Yeah, well said. Two quick points on this. Firstly, the word genocide has been used a lot, and I think justifiably. You're seeing, obviously, ethnic cleansing. You're seeing this push of Gazans from the north of the territory into the south. You've seen now Israel talking about commencing a very protracted military campaign in the south. Of course, then people have nowhere else to go but Egypt. They have to leave Palestine altogether. You're seeing collective punishment, war crimes. But in particular, on that point of genocide, when you see the targeting of universities, of hospitals, when you make the north of Gaza uninhabitable, you completely destroy, wipe out any social infrastructure which people can return to, I think that's pretty strong evidence. Then combine it to the fact that you're making it by design impossible to get food into that territory. Once more, I think that's pretty strong evidence. Then finally, it's not just aid workers that aren't going to want to operate in Gaza under any conditions, because their own governments literally won't give a toss about them. It's journalists too. It's something I've been thinking about all day, Mike. You know, here at Navarra Media, we've thought about, okay, well, if we want to get people over there, where would they go? Maybe the West Bank, maybe Jordan. How do we do it? How do we operationalize it? If we did send people over there, it's perfectly possible. There's a non-trivial chance they'd be targeted by Israel. And yeah. The worst thing of all is that the government wouldn't do anything about it. The British government wouldn't do anything about it. They seem to be saying that Israel should investigate these things themselves and that hopefully they'll come up to a better solution. Hope, 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 hope. Your job as the government is to protect your citizens. But it seems to have been lost on both major parties. Really, really, like I say, extraordinary story. You might think, well, it's only three people, Aaron. Tens of thousands of people have died. Are you privileging the lives of British nationals above Gazans? I'm not. It's the political response to this, which has just shocked me. Has shocked me. Next story. Yesterday, Israel bombed a building next to the Iranian embassy in Damascus. That killed Iran's most senior general in the Levant, Mohammad Reza Zahedi, as well as his deputy and five other officers of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard. Iran claims that the building served as a consulate and that Zahedi had diplomatic status, meaning his killing marks a major breach of international convention. Now, as with Israel's other breaches of international law, such as the collective punishment of civilians in Gaza, it appears that Israel is being allowed to play by an entirely different set of rules. And that, for the IDF and other countries' diplomatic buildings and personnel, a fair game. Israeli sources have indicated that the site was bombed as members of the IRGC met with Palestinian Islamic Jihad, the PIJ. Whether that's true or not, if the building is recognized as a diplomatic site, such a gathering would be protected under international conventions. Now, this isn't the first time a senior IRGC commander has been killed by Israel in the region. The previous Quds Force, second-in-command in Lebanon and Syria, Syed Radi Mousavi, was assassinated in a suspected Israeli operation late last year. Like Zahedi, he held diplomatic credentials. Regarding what all this means going forward, Amwaj Media, which is a really excellent source for Iranian foreign policy, writes this. One distinguishing aspect of Iran's mission in Syria is the number of high-profile casualties. In February 2013, IRGC commander Hassan Shateri was slain on the road between Damascus and Beirut. Tehran quickly blamed Israel. 2 years later, in early 2015, senior military commander Mohammed Ali Al-Adadi lost his life in a reported Israeli strike alongside several other officers from Iran and members of Lebanese Hezbollah. But while killings of high-ranking officers in Syria are nothing new, the pace of suspected Israeli assassinations has surged since the eruption of the Gaza War in October 2023. The attack on Mousavi, the IRGC's second-in-command in the Levant, was on par with the US killing of former IRGC Quds Force commander Qasem Soleimani and Israel's targeting of late Hezbollah military chief Imad Mughniyeh, experts say. Mousavi had been in charge of facilitating the entry of Iran-led forces and arms shipments to Syria and Hezbollah. As Tehran was reeling from the shock incident, another suspected Israeli airstrike only weeks later killed the Quds Force intelligence deputy in Syria. Trita Parsi is a co-founder of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. He spoke to CNN about what the fallout of this might look like and what could happen next.
You believe these targeted assassinations are, in fact, a significant escalation in the Middle East conflict. What I want to ask you, though, is what kind of fallout do you think we can expect?
Well, one of the most immediate fallouts may be that this uneasy ceasefire that has existed now for 6 weeks between the United States and militias in Iraq and Syria, who prior to that were targeting U.S. troops on a daily basis, and as you remember, killed 3 U.S. troops in a base in Jordan and Syria. That has been as a result of pressure by the United States on these militias, but also by Iran. And now the Iranians have sent a message to the U.S. through the Swiss. It appears that the Iranians are holding the U.S. responsible for what Israel has done, just as much as Israel holds, or the U.S. holds Iran responsible for what the Iraqi militias do. And the message appears to have been, or may have been, that this truce is now over, and we may see an increase, a resumption of attacks by Iraqi militias and Syrian militias against U.S. troops. And that would mean that the Israeli attack on Iran actually has put a target on the backs of American troops in the Middle East.
Now, this is such an important point. After October, because of Israel's incursion into Gaza, there were a huge number of attacks on U.S. targets in Syria, in Iraq, right across the region. Those stopped because of an understanding, actually, that Iran could rein in particularly Shia militias in Iraq. And now they're likely to start again because Israel is repeatedly targeting Iran. And yet we're meant to think that Iran is the country which is destabilizing the region, leading to chaos. No, it's Israel doing this because perhaps they want the US to stay embroiled in West Asia. Maybe they don't want them to pivot to China. Maybe it suits them if American soldiers, in the words of Trita Parsi, have a target on their back in places like Iraq and Syria. Let's go back to what Trita Parsi on CNN had to say next.
I want to ask you about your opinion that you've already, you know, elaborated on, that Israel is in fact engaged in a deliberate, you call it deliberate and systemic effort to destroy existing laws and norms around warfare. Is the issue for you the fact that this could have been an Iranian consulate or embassy of sorts?
No, it's the systematic approach in which almost every law of war, every norm of war, have now been broken by the Israelis over the course of the last 6 months. Targeting of hospitals, even assassinations of patients inside of hospitals, forced famine, an attack on a consulate or an embassy. I mean, even during times of war, the rule is you do not attack or bomb embassies of other countries, even the country that you may be at war with. All of these norms and laws have been broken by Israel over the course of the last 6 months. And it's gotten to the point in which it doesn't appear to be accident. It appears to be a systematic effort to essentially undo the norms and laws around war, or at a minimum, put Israel above them, create a new normal in which Israel is not held to the same laws of war that exist for everyone else.
Parsi there is identifying how Israel has increasingly behaved like a rogue state par excellence. And yet that's a word the media loves to use for Iran, a rogue state. The implication there is that rogue states should be punished for defying international law, norms, and conventions. So why isn't Israel being punished? Let's be honest. Rogue state only applies to countries the US is hostile to. Turkey and Syrian Kurdistan, not a rogue state. Israel and Gaza, absolutely not a rogue state. Here, have another $14 billion worth of aid. The US illegally invading Iraq. Come on. That's what we like to call the international rules-based order. And Parsi there makes a really important point, namely that we should see this attack as being on a continuum with everything else Israel does. Simply put, it no longer thinks it should play by the rules everyone else has to adhere to. Yet, as I've already said, many people that go on about Russia being a threat to the rules-based international order seem strangely quiet when it comes to events in West Asia. Funny that. At stake here is something of real importance. What kind of international order do we want for the next 50 or 100 years? Sometimes when we discuss Israel-Palestine, something I hear is, why should I care? It doesn't affect me. We're here in Britain. Haven't we got enough of our own problems? I don't buy that for one second. But here's the thing. That order that we construct over the next 50 to 100 years might look very different to the one we've been accustomed to the Second World War. Are we going to simply allow it to become normal for civilians to be collectively punished for the acts of others? Are we going to allow it to become mundane when children are permitted to starve to death or where hospitals and universities are actively targeted? Finally, Trita Parsi was asked about what should happen to Iran.
Obviously, the U.S. believes Iran ordered that attack. What do you believe is the proper response then? Because as you point out, we may be pivoting here to quite an escalation.
Well, first of all, whether Israel is dealing with a rogue state or terrorism does not mean that international law does not apply to it. It certainly seems to be trying to create a reality in which it is not held to international law, but it is, and it doesn't matter who it is fighting in those type of circumstances. In regards to what the U.S. response should have been, it's very clear that these escalations by the Iraqi militias, who are supported by Iran, no doubt, are coming as a response to what is happening in Gaza.
Again, that should be something which is obvious. It's backed up by the evidence. When there was a ceasefire, those attacks stopped. That should be something which is observed by every single journalist out there, CNN, BBC, even Fox News, why not? And yet it takes, like I say, somebody like Parsi, who is an outsider. He's somebody involved in, let's say, a think tank which is heterodox on international affairs. It takes somebody like him to speak common sense. Elsewhere today on this subject, we also saw Israeli government spokesman David Mensah.
Ideological to practical. Iran is seeking the destruction of the state of Israel. Iran is not only our enemy. Iran is the enemy of the US, UK, France, Germany, and all free nations. So we have to win. There is no substitute for victory.
Now, when I watched that, I thought a few things. Firstly, does this gentleman want a regional war, which includes the US, the UK, and other European powers? Because personally, I don't think that British nationals should shed a single drop of blood for what's going on right now in West Asia. And I find it particularly strange, given that he looks like he couldn't fight his way out of a brown paper bag. In any case, secondly, when I watched that, I thought to myself, this Mr. Mensah chap, he looks rather familiar. And then it clicked. He was on Talk TV alongside James Schneider in possibly the most outlandish media moment of 2023.
This is an incredibly intense humanitarian catastrophe. And that's why the people of this country want to see a ceasefire. And that's why Keir Starmer is failing in his duty as leader of the opposition to not call for it.
James is, of course, a pound shop academic who underwrote, who sustained, who was the right-hand man of Jeremy Corbyn. Jeremy Corbyn, who certainly failed in his role as being leader of the Labour Party, giving the Labour Party its worst possible election result since the 1930s. But of course, he also pushed me and my family out of the Labour Party, where I was a member for the last 20 years or so, and he pushed me and my family over to live in Israel. That's what anti-Semitism does in the UK. And James endorsed it. James, of course, is not the most trustworthy of people, because he was, of course, before being vaguely associated with the Labour Party, leading Momentum. But of course, before that, he was president of the Lib Dem Society. And of course, he's been writing for the Conservative Home newspaper. So James is a tin pot student politician that really should stay in the student union. This is about big boy politics.
Well,
okay,
well,
this
well,
is about real lives.
All right, David. I hear there's a lot in there. We learned a lot about James's CV as well here. Didn't know about the Conservative Home bit.
But well, it's the, not true.
The pound shop academic stuff. I mean, you're not really the man to be talking about this, is David's point.
Well, I think he's still going.
It's time to expose your hypocrisy. It's time to expose your love of Jew haters. And it's time to put an end to Hamas. And all right-thinking people, all genuine people would agree with that notion.
Okay.
While, of course, protecting the lives of hostages and, of course, of ordinary Palestinian people.
I mean, I said it was one of the strangest moments of 2023. There was a lot more too, but of course, we've got a lot to discuss this evening. My God, they got rid of Levy and got this guy in. And by the way, you hear his accent. He's English. I say this as somebody who's British-Iranian. Mate, you're English, okay? The idea that he can go to West Asia, that he's helping expel people from their homes in Gaza. There are people that sound like that, that are going into the West Bank and literally booting people out of their homes with these illegal settlements. And they say it's our historic homeland from thousands of years ago. You sound like you should be presenting a show on Radio 4. Incredible. And by the way, as you saw from the graphic there, this gentleman was the former director of Labour Friends of Israel. Now, between 2015 and 2019, when Jeremy Corbyn was leader of the Labour Party, if you said, hold on, the Labour Friends of Israel have to answer a few questions. Who are they fundamentally serving? Is this about representing the interests of Israel in Britain? And if it is, what happens when there's a conflict of interest between Israel and the UK, as there is when Israel kills three of our people? Now, if you said that between 2015 and 2019, you were an anti-Semite, of course. And yet we've got somebody who's gone from being the director of Labour Friends of Israel, who is trying to actively influence British politics. That's what you do. It's interest representation. It's lobbying. He's gone from that to being a literal spokesperson for the government of another country. Mike, what's your views on all of this? And key question, is Israel a rogue state?
People need to understand the gravity of what's happened. Israel have attacked the consulate of a sovereign nation in another sovereign nation. This is bonkers stuff. And I think the point about norms is really, really important here. Because when you think about norms, people often talk about norms as though norms are static, but norms can change over time. And I think what's happening and what's happened over the last 6 months is the erosion of the norms of what we expect to happen in a war, right? Because Israel have been acting for the past 6 months with impunity. They've been doing so because they know that Western leaders and others do not want to call them out, right? They're scared of calling out Israel. They didn't want to call out Israel. And if anything, they're giving Israel some kind of moral authority to commit its genocide, right? So that's the problem here. And I think based on what we've seen, I think Israel absolutely is a rogue state. What Israel is doing, it goes above and beyond any red lines. Again, attacking the consulates of a sovereign nation in another sovereign nation is beyond, it's insane stuff. On top of that, we're talking about targeted aid workers, refugee camps, hospitals. This is, you know, next level stuff here. So I think we need to be absolutely clear about, you know, the language we're using here. Because I think often, it's, you know, often what happens is these labels are attached to these things after they happen, right? So you don't call it genocide until maybe 20 years down the line or 10 years down the line. You know, you might not call Israel a rogue state because you're a bit worried about the implications of that, and it's a really strong claim. But I think it's important, given the gravity of the situation, that we are using the right labels. As someone who's an academic, I think labels and vernacular and concepts, all of these things are really, really important to me. And I think, you know, rogue state fits Israel given its acts and given what it's doing. These things are beyond the pale. It's eroding the norms and the kind of international rules-based order. It's eroding all of those things. It's the first thing. Yes, I think it's really, really important to kind of acknowledge that. And I think, you know, labels like genocide, again, these are strong labels, but based on what's happening in Gaza, these labels fit. So I think it's important we're using the right labels. And I think it's important that, you know, we don't shy away from that, because often we can shy away from that. You'll be a bit nervous about these labels being so strong and so kind of damning. But unfortunately, this is the nature of the last 6 months. The last 6 months have shown us that these labels absolutely do fit. So I think it is really, really horrible. And that kind of rant by that fella on Talk TV is just bonkers stuff. And I think the kind of Labour Friends of Israel group, there needs to be some, probably more focus on the interests they serve and on the idea of, you know, what that group is all about. Because I think it is, you know, some aspects of that group is deeply worrying in my view.
Next story. Israel's war in Gaza has been treacherous political terrain for the Labour Party. They aren't in government, so they can't do very much. At least, that's what they like to say. But they likely soon will be. What is more, Labour are meant to be the more progressive of Britain's two major parties. And those who particularly care about events in Gaza, from anti-war activists to British Muslims, are more likely to vote for them. Now, you might not have heard of Pat McFadden, but he is an influential figure within Keir Starmer's circle. Alongside the party leader Rachel Reeves and Angela Rayner, McFadden is generally viewed as certain to be a top figure in any Labour government. So what he says matters, and we should pay close attention. This morning he appeared on Sky News, where Kay Burley put this question to him.
Is Labour comfortable selling arms to Israel?
Look, we always want Israel or any ally to abide by international humanitarian law. We've said that all the way through this conflict. And, you know, that's what guides our policy.
So is that a yes or a no? I'm not sure.
Well, we don't have a boycott of selling arms to Israel.
Even given what's happening in Gaza at the moment?
Look, there are three things which have guided our policy since this phase of this began 6 months ago. One is the return of the hostages, some of whom are still being held.
Yeah.
The second is a sustainable stop to this conflict, not just a pause where it starts up again in a few months.
But you're not answering my question.
What is your question?
My question is Labour comfortable selling arms to Israel at the moment? Would you be?
If we are selling arms to allies who are abided by international humanitarian law, then that's something that...
So you do think that Israel's abiding by international
law? Well, if there's proper legal evidence that they aren't, the government should come out and say so. We've said this all the way through.
We always want Israel or any ally to abide by international humanitarian law. Okay, sounds good. But if they aren't, then what do you do? Do you allow them to keep buying weapons from the UK? If it can be established that Israel has broken international law, what would Labour do about it rather than say, oh, we really wish you wouldn't? McFadden even smirks when Burley put that question to him a second time. So either he isn't taking this very seriously or he doesn't think it's particularly important. We're only talking about the collective punishment of civilians. We're only talking about 13,000 kids dying, or on that day, us finding out that three UK nationals were killed. But can you imagine McFadden's attitude if this was Russia or Iran, if they'd killed all those kids and bombed an embassy and killed the aid workers? I can't. I think he'd be a hell of a lot more angry. He might even be upset. Now, perhaps McFadden's relaxed attitude here can be explained by the fact he's a member of Labour Friends of Israel, LFI. Indeed, he's not just a member, he's a parliamentary officer for the organisation. This is an extraordinary number. Labour Friends of Israel counts 73 Labour MPs as parliamentary supporters. So almost half of the Labour Party are, quote, friends of Israel. I personally think every single one of them should be asked if they're friends of the country that just killed three of their compatriots, including Pat McFadden. And by the way, Keir Starmer is amongst those 73 Labour Friends of Israel. Mike, what did you make of McFadden's response? It struck me as incredibly blasé given the broader context.
Yeah, it was incredibly blasé. And I think Labour's response throughout the last 6 months has been nothing short of wholly disgusting, really. I think let's cast our minds back to 2020, when Keir Starmer was running to be the leader of the Labour Party, and he spoke about how human rights would be central to its foreign policy approach under his leadership, right? So we fast forward to 2024, and the kind of greatest crime of our age, as I described this what's going on in Gaza earlier, Labour are committed to being on the wrong side of history. And history will remember where Labour were and what Labour was saying and doing during the greatest crime of our age. And what Labour have been doing essentially is justifying Israel's, you know, genocide, some kind of condemnation, but again, assuming Israel's acting in good faith, the kind of flawed liberal consensus they always speak about on Navarra. And I think that contribution we just seen there, or, you know, with Kay Burley, is another reminder of this. You know, Labour aren't willing to, you know, deliver some home truths on what Israel's doing and deliver the idea that, you know, Israel is violating international laws, international norms, and, you know, this kind of tepid criticism of, you know, it's bad that people are dying, but we will still, you know, support Israel, and it's, you know, delivered in this really monosyllabic tone, and it's frustrating to me. It's deeply frustrating to me. People seem to think this is all about winning the election, right? So the idea that, okay, Labour might lose a couple of votes over this, but it's all right. They're going to win the election anyway, so that's fine. No, that's not how it works, right? Because Labour's stance on this should be used as a heuristic for its stance on other issues linked to human rights. How can we trust Labour Party to defend human rights in Britain when it's not criticising a state which has killed British citizens, when it has Labour members, parliamentary members, part of a group that's Labour Friends of Israel, when Israel are committing acts of genocide which are affecting British citizens, for example? How can we trust them to defend human rights given their stance on this entire issue? So I think in many ways, yes, Labour might win the election, partly because Conservatives are an absolute mess. Fantastic, wonderful stuff, amazing, all of that stuff, right? But we can't ignore its stance on this big issue. We simply cannot. And I think its stance on this issue is fundamental in potentially guiding the direction of a Labour government on other issues, linked to human rights. How can we trust them on these other issues? I think so that's where I am with this. And I think people... Yeah, some people want us to just kind of forget this stance because, hey, look, we need these big boys back in governments, the sensible adults back in governments to guide and rescue Britain and steer the ship in the right direction. I'm increasingly worried about what Labour government has to offer for us. Like, increasingly worried to the point where, you know, I'm genuinely anxious about this, right? So I think we need to be really, really, you know, stern about Labour and its lack of critique on you know, Israel, because it is a deep worry for what might lie ahead for us. The problem I've had throughout this crisis is the gaslighting. So if you remember, there's an LBC appearance by Keir Starmer. I think he often goes on there with Nick Ferrari, right? And he spoke about how Israel has the right to cut off electricity and water, right? And then a couple of months later, it was like, no, I didn't say that, when we literally saw the footage. So what's going to happen is, at some point, Labour are going to be forced into a slightly more principled position than they're currently occupying, right? It'll probably happen because the US have taken the lead and, you know, Starmer now thinks, oh, okay, well, you know, Biden said this, I can kind of maybe shift slightly to a more progressive position on this because, you know, the US have done so as well. And then they're going to pretend that was always their position. Oh, no, we always fought this. Come on. You know, we always defended this. No, you didn't. The tapes are there. The footage is there. The tweets are there. We will remember this. And I think it's important that voters keep this in the back of their mind when it comes to future Labour governments.
I was thinking, watching that clip of McFadden, you know, the equivalent, I think, for his job under Corbyn was Rebecca Long-Bailey, I think. Can you imagine the media response if, when she was asked that question, on the day we find out 3 UK nationals were killed, if she'd smirked like that? Can you imagine? I mean, she would have been out of the job within 3 hours. You know, we would have had the LBC call-ins. God knows. They would have, you know, it would have been like the bat signal for Panorama and John Ware and Newsnight. It would have been like, right, get her. But of course, you can just, you know, be so blasé about something which is going to impact all of us and nobody cares, because of course it's the Labour right. Also, and I think this goes back to what you were saying a moment ago, Mike, there is a very strong possibility that Israel wants to escalate what's going on right now. They need to maintain, as my colleague Michael Walker has pointed out many, many times, very astute observation, they need to keep the United States in that part of the world. It's in their interest. The United States wants to pivot towards Asia because it recognizes, rightly, that, you know, the, the main rival in the 21st century is China. It doesn't really care about the Middle East. But Israel wants to keep them there. And it increasingly seems like the best way to do that is to create a regional war of some kind with Iran. That's what they want to do. It doesn't need to be a hot, hot war, but some kind of low-level, you know, permanent war with Iran. Primarily through proxies, but maybe not. Maybe you see some bombing of various sites in Iran. I don't think a ground invasion wouldn't be plausible, but, you know, something like that to keep the United States entrenched in that part of the world. And my worry is, as somebody who's in the UK, we have 73 Labour MPs who are quote-unquote friends of Israel. 73! So if Israel wants that war, do they just nod their heads and go, yes? Because, by the way, to those 73 MPs, you're meant to be representing your constituents here in Britain. Crazy idea, I know. You're meant to be thinking, first and foremost, about those three people, those three UK nationals, the kinds of people you're paid to represent. They're meant to matter more than the little lobbyists that you have brunch with in London. I know, again, that's a radical idea. Maybe it's even old-fashioned, but that's meant to be how a democracy works. And like I say, if there is some kind of regional escalation, those 73 members, and it'll be more because there'll be more Labour MPs after the next general election, those Labour friends of Israel, what are the conditions that have to be met for them not to be friends of Israel? Will they allow themselves to be drawn into another reckless, stupid, idiotic, counterproductive war in West Asia? Because let's remember, Labour has form on that. They did it 20 years ago. Not a single drop of blood of a UK national should be shed for what's going on. And if that's the future of this project, Labour Friends of Israel, I think really there should be no place for them in politics. You're paid. Your job is to look after people in this country, not to be part of a promotional effort to start a war thousands of miles away. Now, Keir Starmer's position on Israel's ruthless assault on Gaza continues to create problems within the Labour Party. 20 Labour councillors in Lancashire have now quit Labour in protest at the party's leadership. Those 20 councillors represented Labour on three local councils. That includes all 10 of the Labour members of Pendle Borough Council who've quit the party, along with its leader. The other 10 Labour councillors sat on Briarfield Town Council and Nelson Town Council. All of them will now form an independent group. Pendle Borough Council leader Asjad Mahmood said this in a statement. I, along with my colleagues, was elected by local residents to represent them in the council chamber. As a Labour councillor, I've always felt the party's policies were aligned with my own beliefs and those of the constituents who have honoured me with their votes. Sadly, over a recent period, senior party officials have attempted to impose their ideas at a local level. I was elected to serve the public, not party officials. We could have a few more Labour MPs say that. I was elected to serve the public, not Labour Friends of Israel. The Lancashire defection is the largest since Starmer became Labour leader, and it follows the resignation of 11 councillors in Burnley in November. They quit over Starmer's decision not to press for a ceasefire in Gaza, and in total, over 70 Labour councillors have resigned in protest at his position. Starmer's reluctance to take a clear stance on Israel's war on Gaza also seems to have impacted the party's membership. Labour has now seen its membership fall by 23,000 in just 2 months. And that's because of its policies on Gaza and its U-turn on the environment. That's according to The Guardian. A National Executive Committee member, Luke Aitkhurst, said this about those figures. Party membership is still at historically high levels. Labour only had 150,000 members at the end of its last period in office in 2010. The state of the opinion polls suggests there is no correlation between membership and electoral popularity. Can you imagine a more dismissive message to members? We don't care what you think or what you do. We just want your money. You are totally irrelevant. And by the way, ahead of the 1997 landslide, Labour's party membership went from 250,000 to over 400,000 people. People were enthusiastic about a change of government. They joined the Labour Party. At one point, Tony Blair was talking about 1 million members. Meanwhile, in 2024, they've not even won, and people are already walking away. So yes, this matters. Anyway, it looks like Labour wasn't very happy with The Guardian running that story. So 2 days later, this story fortuitously appeared in the same newspaper. 4 in 5 Labour members back Keir Starmer, according to polling. Wow, okay, that's pretty impressive. But look at the fine print. If you look a little closer, that polling is from April 2023 and last October. April 2023 and last October. So half of it is a year out of date, and the other half is from before Starmer's position on Gaza started to have an impact. That is, almost without question, a political cleanup from The Guardian after the Labour leadership threw a wobbly. How dare you publish this? We want you to do us a favour. Here's a great story. Here's a piece of news from 6 months ago. Nobody thinks something that happens in October is news, except it seems The Guardian. But there's no denying that the Labour leadership is popular with a decent proportion of Labour voters. After all, their polling is pretty good. And part of his success lies in his commitment to never offending anyone, unless, of course, the left wing. But that means he's incapable of showing real leadership when it's needed. Even on a day when 3 British citizens delivering humanitarian aid in Gaza were blown up by Israel in what looks like a targeted strike. Even then, we get an identikit statement from somebody who wants to be our future Prime Minister. Reports of the death of British nationals, among others from World Central Kitchen, in an Israeli strike on Gaza are horrifying. Our thoughts are with the families of all those killed. We condemn this strike. There must be a full investigation, and those responsible must be held to account. Humanitarian workers put their lives in danger to serve others. Their deaths are outrageous and unacceptable, and it's not the first time aid workers have come under fire in Israel's campaign. International law must be upheld, and humanitarian workers must be protected so they can deliver the aid that is desperately needed. This war must stop now. Far too many innocent people have died in this conflict, and more than 1 million are facing starvation. Labour repeats our call for an immediate ceasefire, the immediate release of all hostages, and full humanitarian access into Gaza. Those responsible must be held to account. Mr. Starmer, the people responsible work for a country who you are a friend of, Israel. But thanks for the thoughts and prayers. Maybe you can get a trending hashtag. Who knows? Next story. In the same 24 hours that Israel bombed an Iranian consulate and killed 7 international aid workers in Gaza, it also managed to pass a law aimed at shutting down critical journalism in the country. Israel has moved to close Al Jazeera in the country after the Knesset passed a law allowing the banning of international media that it says poses a security threat. The law gives the Prime Minister and the Communications Minister direct authority to shut broadcasters down and confiscate their equipment. So not the regulator, it's the Minister and the Prime Minister who are responsible for this. And Benjamin Netanyahu has made it clear that he intends to use it. He said this: Al Jazeera harmed Israel's security, actively participated in the October 7th massacre, and incited against IDF soldiers. It is time to remove the shofar of Hamas from our country. The terrorist channel Al Jazeera will no longer broadcast from Israel. I intend to act immediately in accordance with the new law to stop the channel's activity. I welcome the law promoted by Communications Minister Shlomo Karai with the support of coalition members led by coalition chairman Ofir Katz. The claim that Al Jazeera participated in October 7th is completely unfounded, and it's been refuted on multiple occasions. The Qatar-based broadcaster said this in response: Al Jazeera holds the Israeli Prime Minister responsible for the safety of its staff and network premises around the world following his incitement and this false accusation in a disgraceful manner. Al Jazeera reiterates that such slanderous accusations will not deter us from continuing our bold and professional coverage and reserves the rights to pursue every legal step. This isn't the first time Netanyahu's government has tried to shut down Al Jazeera. Just a week after the 7th of October Hamas attacks, Israel's communications minister said he was trying to find a way to close the network's operations in the country. A month later, the security cabinet decided to hold off on the shutdown, fearing it would undermine Qatar's mediation efforts between Israel and Hamas. So why has Israel pushed through this law now? Well, a diplomatic source told Haaretz this. It's clear that this move is intended to put pressure on Qatar. The law and the curtailing of Al Jazeera activity in Israel are another tool Israel can use to increase pressure on Qatar so it uses its influence over Hamas and makes the organization moderate its positions. Threatening the freedom of the press to report on its war on Gaza is pretty strong evidence of Israel's waning sense of legitimacy. And it comes as both domestic and international support for Netanyahu appears to be slipping away. Speaking at a White House press briefing, spokesperson Karine Jean-Pierre had this reaction to the new law.
I think you're speaking specifically, at least the reports that we've seen is about Al Jazeera specifically, but it doesn't matter, whichever, right, journalist more broadly. But to those particular reports, we've seen the reports, and certainly I'm going to refer to Israel for what they may or may not be considering. But if it is true, a move like this is concerning. We believe in the freedom of the press. It is critical. It is critically important, and the United States supports the critically important work journalists around the world do. And that includes those who are reporting in the conflict in Gaza. So we believe that work is important, the freedom of the press is important, and if those reports are true, it is concerning to us.
Somehow, when it comes to Israel, the US can't seem to get beyond simply voicing their concerns. In 2021, President Joe Biden also found this concerning. That was the moment Israel blew up the Associated Press Tower in Gaza, a building that also housed Al Jazeera. And if Israel does shut down Al Jazeera's reporting from Gaza, it'll be just the latest in a series of steps the country has taken to suppress the organization since the war began. One way it's tried to do this is by appearing to target the network's journalists and their families. In late October, Al Jazeera journalist Wael Al-Dadu was reporting from a hospital in Gaza when he received the news that an Israeli airstrike had killed most of his family. His wife, son, daughter, and grandson were amongst those killed. In January, another of Al-Dadu's sons was killed by an Israeli strike. Hamza Wael Al-Dadu was also a journalist. He was killed alongside fellow journalist Mustafa Thuraya when Israel bombed their car. In December, Al Jazeera journalist Samir Abu Dhaka was killed in an Israeli airstrike on Khan Yunis. Wael Al-Dadu, who was with him at the time, was also injured. Mike, but what's your read on this? On the one hand, Israel has made this case over a long period of time, and it's fair to say Al Jazeera's reporting is unique in so much as it's getting to the facts of what's happening in Gaza. But what really surprised me was less this news, as unwelcome as it is, as much as it is an attack on the freedom of the press, it was Netanyahu's statement and him saying that Al Jazeera was involved in October the 7th, they're effectively terrorists. This seems to me to be the kind of rhetoric you would use if you were trying to paint Qatar as a hostile state. And that seems to me to be quite the escalation.
Yeah, it definitely is an escalation. I think, you know, Netanyahu has in the past also labeled human rights groups as terrorists. And I think part of this is a wider strategy to delegitimize critical reporting of Israel. So we know that Al Jazeera are an important source of news for people in Gaza, right? Which is partly why this is a huge, huge problem, this idea of making Al Jazeera illegal, because for people in Gaza, a lot of the idea of knowing what's going on is partly through Al Jazeera, its reporting, its kind of investigative work, which is so, so thorough. I think as someone who, you know, maybe like 10, 15 years ago when I was sort of learning about this as a younger man, I remember going to lots of Al Jazeera newspaper articles and reading those online and finding out about what's going on through Al Jazeera. So Al Jazeera being at the vanguard of kind of really deep, thorough investigative work on Israel's genocidal campaign against Palestinians for a number of years. And that's partly why, if you're Netanyahu, you want to shut them down, right? Because they are quite literally telling the truth about what's going on. They are exposing your lies. They've done documentaries on this. And more than anything, these journalists have risked their lives to tell the truth, right? You know, we saw footage of the building being blown up. People have died. People have been targeted because of this, because of their fire reporting on this. So I think it is, you know, a huge problem that Netanyahu is deciding to go down this route. But we do know this is part of a wider strategy. Again, human rights groups who have been very, very vocal critics of Netanyahu have been targeted as well. They've been called terrorists as well. All of this is part of that kind of strategy of, I want to do whatever I want. You know, we're going to bomb refugee camps if we have to, and hospitals, and we'll target aid workers if we have to. All of this is part of a wider campaign. All of this kind of comes together. All these stories we've kind of covered today all kind of come together and inform a wider strategy, a really horrible strategy. And again, the idea that Israel can act with impunity because it's been given the green light by Western leaders. So this is a huge problem. And I think the freedom of the press angle is interesting because it's something that, you know, kind of liberal states hold as sacrosanct, right? It's the idea that, no, freedom of press, you know, the ability to, you know, report things forensically and, you know, free speech, all of these things are something that Western states value. Yet all we get in terms of, you know, acknowledgement of this is just, yeah, you know, this is really, really sad. And you're just kind of really tepid statements that we constantly hear, you know, the US raised concerns and I'm sure Starmer will tweet something later on about raising concerns, and David Cameron will tweet something tepid about raising concerns. Yet no one seems to do anything beyond raising these concerns. So it is a real frustration of mine. I think Netanyahu is becoming, and what we've seen over the last 6 months is Netanyahu was already, you know, a fascist and has already espoused some quite deeply and worrying sentiments. But I think in the last kind of 6 months, you've seen him, you know, and I didn't think this was possible given where he was before. We've seen him stoop even lower from where he was before in terms of his attack on, you know, Palestinians, etc. And this kind of attack on Al Jazeera is just kind of another example of how far he's willing to go and how far he's willing to stoop to kind of commit to a genocidal project.
Also, just on this quickly, you know, Shireen Abu Akleh was killed by a sniper. And then Israel proceeded to actually attack people at her funeral. This is not new. This has been happening for a long time. And I don't understand why our country is allied to people that do this. I think actually Israel is the definition right now of a rogue state. We support it in this country. The United States, of course, is now sending, I think, 14, 15, 16 billion US dollars. And as I've said also, we have dozens of MPs who are members of organizations who are quote unquote friends of Israel. Quite extraordinary. You probably noticed the pattern on tonight's show. All the stories were related to Israel. Those were simply the most important stories of the day. There's a pattern there. This is a country which simply doesn't think the rules apply to it. Mike, thanks for joining me this evening. We had a great show. Really, really valued everything you had to say as usual.
Yeah, it was a tough one in terms of the topics we had to cover, but always a pleasure when the B team get to, you know, run Navarra live for the night.
Yeah, it was a pleasure. And it is tough, you know, reading about this stuff, I have to say. It is really tough. My jaw was on the floor when I saw what David Cameron and Rishi Sunak and Keir Starmer had to say about those three UK nationals who were killed. And thanks to all of you for tuning in this evening. Make sure to come back tomorrow for another stream from 6 p.m. You've been watching Navarra Media. Good night.
This broadcast is brought to you by Navarra Media. Go to navarramedia.com/support.